Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Their names both derive from buffalo, and their worlds both revolved around it. I mean, of course, for Sitting Bull, the buffalo was the underpinning of his world and way of life.
Deanne Stillman is one of America's most insightful writers about the American West, both its present day and its past. Today, we're talking to her about her brand new book, Blood Brothers, the story of the strange friendship between Sitting Bull and Buffalo Bill, which we gave a starred review to. Welcome to the show, Deanne.
Thanks a lot, Clay. Really appreciate your having me and your starred review.
So you've obviously written about the Old West before. Tell us a little bit about how you came across the story of the relationship between Sitting Bull and Buffalo Bill.
Well, it started while I was working on a previous book of mine, Mustang, which is American History by Way of the Wild Horse. And I found out that, first of all, Sitting Bull had been in Buffalo Bill's Wild West show for 4 months during 1885, which surprised me. And then that second of all, when Sitting Bull went home to Standing Rock at the end of that four-month period, Cody gave him the horse that he rode in the show. And that
Cody is Buffalo Bill Cody.
Buffalo Bill, yes.
Yep.
5 years later, in 1890, in December, when Sitting Bull was ambushed and killed at his cabin, the horse was outside, and it had been trained to dance at the sound of gunfire while in the Wild West show, and it danced again as the bullets were flying amid Sitting Bull's murder, according to legend, at any rate.
Mm-hmm.
But I happen to believe it, and the image haunted me for a number of years. I was just really stunned by it. I mean, I thought, here's this horse from Buffalo Bill that Sitting Bull rode, and you know, the horse symbolized freedom, and horses had been stripped from the tribes during the Indian Wars, and it just really represented so much. And then here it was at the end of Sitting Bull's life, bleeding for him. And in fact, after I began working on Blood Brothers, I called Chief Arvel Looking Horse of the Lakota tribe, a noted elder and leader of the tribe who has organized ceremonies around the world, you know, about various sacred concerns. And I called him to ask about this dancing horse. And he was the person who just really told me something that completely blew me away, which was that the horse really was taking the bullets for Sitting Bull. I mean, I had already been quite fascinated by the image and thought that it had entered the ghost dance, which was the religious frenzy during which Sitting Bull was assassinated and blamed for. You know, this dance that the Lakota and other tribes were doing as a way to kind of resurrect the past. It was this apocalyptic movement that was sweeping the tribes, and Sitting Bull was held responsible for it and triggered his own assassination. Because he was blamed for it, that triggered his assassination. So I felt that the horse had become part of this ghost dance, a ghost horse in effect. But then, as I said, Chief Looking Horse kind of took it in an even deeper direction for me by saying that it was the horse taking the bullets. So then, as I thought about that over the years, while I was working on Blood Brothers, you know, it really drove home this idea that Sitting Bull and Cody had shared this bloody history. Of course, they were first enemies and then friends, as one of the publicity slogans for the Wild West show says, mm-hmm. foes in 76, referring to the little bighorn, and friends in 85. Mm-hmm. And the horse, just again, it all kept coming back to that dancing horse outside Sitting Bull's cabin when he was killed.
Yeah.
That's really how I got into Blood Brothers.
Yeah. At this remove of history, I mean, and all the myth that surrounds them, I mean, tell us a little bit what Sitting Bull and Buffalo Bill were like, each in their own way.
Well, I mean, in one way, they were a lot alike. They were icons of their time and for their own people. You know, both were revered by their own tribes. Sitting Bull was an important figure among the Lakota. He had been considered, his power had been noted, his personal power had been noted even when he was a little boy, and he kind of knew that was his fate to be, you know, a leader for his people and all that would entail. He knew it was a hard road that he had ahead of him. It was an honorable path. He foresaw his own murder. Well, I shouldn't say he, for a Medalar. He was very attuned to the animal world and received messages from animals. And at one point, a Medalark told him he would be killed by his own people. So he kind of regarded himself as a player in this greater drama,
mm-hmm.
and accepted it and just followed that path. Now, Cody himself was larger than life. He was a noted scout and hunter and showman, and he attained the name Buffalo Bill by participating in a contest involving the killing of buffalo and killing more than another guy who was vying for the name Buffalo Bill. And strangely, both Buffalo Bill and Sitting Bull have names that are directly linked with the buffalo. I mean, the link for Cody is obvious, Buffalo Bill. Sitting Bull's Lakota name, Tatanka Iotaki, means, I believe, I may be getting this slightly wrong, but it's resting buffalo calf. And they respected each other as warriors. I mean, you know, Sitting Bull was essentially a prisoner of war when he joined the show, but it was a way off the reservation. And when I recount in my book his meeting with Buffalo Bill in, of all places, Buffalo, his first meeting after he was signed up for the show. And Cody makes this speech where he tells the throngs that Sitting Bull was kind of the Napoleon of his people, you know, this incredible general and leader, and he didn't kill Custer. He shouldn't be like excoriated as this person who killed Custer. He was really to be respected.
I mean, but you write, yeah. You know, from a young age that Sitting Bull was sort of mature beyond his years and certainly a compassionate child. You write at several points in this book, actually, that Sitting Bull had the ability to, quote, see and feel the past and the future. Can you just say a little bit about what you mean by that?
Well, he, like, you know, a number of his fellow tribes people were very, you know, in tune with their surroundings. You know, they lived in a teepee, which was a circle, not a square, the way white people lived. They took into account the four directions, east, west, north, and south. They, you know, listened to animals. They knew that everything they did had to sync up with the wilderness in some way. And it's not to say that every single Indian followed that code, because, you know, they're not unlike the rest of us. They're, you know, some people didn't. Some people do the right thing and some people don't. But he was incredibly intuitive and humble and quiet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that he wasn't, you know, proud of his accomplishments as a warrior, but as somebody who he knew how to get quiet and listen to things.
Yeah.
You know, he heard it all. You know, that really shaped him in a lot of ways, in every way.
Yeah.
From the time he was in his mother's womb, when he received some information about his destiny, and throughout his life, he heeded dreams that he had. You know, the Sundance was he was maybe first and foremost a sun dancer. Mm-hmm. The Sundance was a ritual that of sacrifice, and well, just leave it at that.
So you've written about horses before, and you write about Comanche General Custer's horse in Blood Brothers in a kind of memorable way. What keeps you returning to writing about horses?
Well, just a brief correction. First of all, it's really Comanche belonged to Miles Keough, who was a captain in Custer's cavalry.
Okay.
Well, I grew up around horses. My mother was one of the first women in the country to ride professionally on the racetrack as an exercise boy, as it used to call them. And she herself was quite an equestrian and had horses and taught me and my sister to ride when we were little. Mm-hmm. And I never liked being in Cleveland, which is where I grew up. Mm-hmm. And having this contact, well, being taught how to ride as a little girl kind of fueled this wanderlust that I had. And my father had taught me to write and often read to me his favorite writers, including Edgar Allan Poe. And he would read one of Poe's poems, El Dorado, Gaily Bedight a Gallant Knight, and Sunshine and Shadow, that one.
Yeah.
And I would imagine myself living inside that poem. I mean, it really, that also kind of, it became an escape hatch for me and fueled my wanderlust and showed me that there was a way out of Ohio and I didn't have to spend my life ice fishing or, you know, other activities involving cold weather.
Right.
But it, more than that, I mean, there was, you know, I had a fair amount of turmoil in my own family and so on. And so all of this living inside this poem and thinking about the West and wide open space and horses and all these incredible characters that I could meet, you know, like Crazy Horse and Calamity Jane and Cody and Sitting Bull and so on, that kind of, I don't know, I just started living inside of all that. At one point when I was writing Mustang, one of the things that drew me into writing Mustang was I found out that 34 wild horses had been killed outside of Reno in 1998 at Christmas time. And I had been wanting for a long time to repay this favor that horses had done for my family, which was provide us with a living. And then that became kind of, I didn't know how I would do that. I just wanted to do that someday. And then when I learned about this massacre, that became the prism through which I began looking at this whole story of, you know, the role of the wild horse in the making of America and so on. And then, as I said, finding out about this, the dancing horse outside Sitting Bull's cabin led me to write Blood Brothers. It just, what a powerful image, right?
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that one of Sitting Bull's reasons for agreeing to be in the Wild West show was that, you know, he was able to get off the reservation and see what the rest of the country was like. But he also wanted, he kept asking, can I meet the white grandfather? And by that, he meant the American president, because he wanted to explain to the white grandfather, you know, what his people wanted and needed. First of all, did that ever come to fruition for him? And did he ever feel, I guess, disillusioned?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'm glad you're asking about that. He never did get to meet the president, although the cast of the Wild West did get to D.C. and inside the Capitol building during that four-month period that he was traveling with the Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the Indians in the show were given a tour of one of the rooms in the State Department, and they were, this is really bizarre, they were shown, I can't remember, you know, it was a high-ranking official in the government, and they were shown into a room where there was lots of frontier art on the wall, like paintings of buffalo and scenes of the West.
Mm-hmm.
Which, of course, they had just been kicked out of. And apparently some of the men who were there, some of the Native Americans started laughing when they, you know, saw this art. Sitting Bull, there's nothing I read in any of the reports about that talks about Sitting Bull's reaction.
Mm-hmm.
He, a couple of reports say that he actually did meet the president then, but most of them say that he didn't. And in any case, no, he was certainly not able to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to go face to face with the grandfather and say, hey, you know, like, what's up? You've betrayed my people and why? And he was not able to do that. He did say that to other generals he had encountered over the years, some of whom were his captors. So there's certainly a record of his, you know, him making those statements and trying to confront white people, you know, white officials when he could about that. But I believe he was, this is just my guess, I believe he was possibly heartbroken or at least extremely disappointed by the fact that he could not have that conversation with the president then. That was a major reason for his joining the show.
Yeah.
And it was shortly after that that he decided to go back to Standing Rock. I mean, he was homesick. Something else he noticed during his travels was that, first of all, there were so many white people, and he realized that as he went from city to city, if he knew there were this many white people, he probably wouldn't have engaged in the wars, because there was no way they could win, that the Indians could win. And also, he realized that white people were so technologically superior, you know, certainly in terms of gun power. And while he was traveling, he would be given tours of factories and like firehouses where people would show him, you know, new marvels like fire trucks and their sirens and clanging bells and stuff like that, and all these gadgets and gear, and, you know, it was quite impressive in one way. But then he also, something else he saw during his travels was all these like poor white orphans on the road. You know, there were the frontier in America at that time in the 1880s was a pretty rough place. You know, there were wealthy people in cities, but there were a lot of poor people as well. And there were lots of poor kids wandering around the West. And he would encounter them on the road and sometimes often give them money. Mm. Cody, too, was quite generous and helped out a lot of people over the years. You know, think about who was in the cast of the Wild West. These were cowboys and Indians who were out of luck and out of a way of life and out of a job as the West was being foreclosed. Mm-hmm. And the only way they could keep living inside of that was inside Cody's carnival.
Yeah.
And these were very, you know, like rough and tumble characters, a lot of them. And as I write about in my book, Annie Oakley was in the show too, and she was a pivotal figure in the lives of Cody and Sitting Bull. And another reason that Sitting Bull agreed to join up with Cody is that Annie Oakley, whom he had met earlier during one of her shooting exhibitions while he was traveling with another group, they immediately hit it off, and he was very impressed with her and gave her the nickname Little Miss Sure Shot, which actually was mistranslated. It really meant little person who does good things. But, you know, he was... what if he never said that? He kind of branded her, to use today's parlance. They became very good friends, and Annie Oakley was a very close friend of Buffalo Bill's, and I think, you know, and he did his fair share of womanizing and had a number of mistresses over the years. I think he loved Annie Oakley, but she was not a girlfriend of his, and she was quite devoted to her husband, Frank Butler, another sharpshooter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a fascinating story. So,
yeah.
The West, I mean, you know, over your writing career has obviously been a real source of fascination for you. Do you think you could write about another place?
I probably can. I mean, I'm not sure how much else I can say about the West, modern or frontier.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know. I just may have said what I have to say at this point.
Yeah.
You know, I've done it in four books and covered, you know, a fair amount of territory geographically and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe.
Well, I hope you keep writing about it, because you do such a great job with it. Congrats.
Well, thanks a lot,
on
Clay.
Blood Brothers. And
thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Megan, I think of you as the Annie Oakley of book journalism.
I'm so flattered, Clay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Little sharpshooter.
I was thinking a few things during that interview. One is, I too am trained to dance at the sound of gunfire. And also, curious that Sitting Bull went home to Standing Rock.
Yeah, that's where they were keeping him and his tribe. So, yeah. So who are you going to talk to today?
Today, I'm talking with Caitlin Doty, and I'm very excited about this book because it explores funeral rites around the world.
Nice.
So don't sound too excited.
Well, I'm just thinking about how grim today's episode is. We're talking about the death of Native Americans in this country and modern ways of death. So
I know, and it's not even our Halloween episode yet.
I know. Oh, gosh. All right, well, let's call Caitlin up.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Hi, I'm Allie Hilfiger.
And I'm Steve Hash.
And we're the hosts of Sit-In on Podcast One.
Join us as we travel around the world visiting creative people in their homes, studios, and the places they work to discuss their story, process, and basically everything in between.
We're sitting down with the biggest names in the world of fashion, art, and music, like Tommy Hilfiger, Gigi Hadid, Bryan Adams, Martin Lawrence Ballard, and Zanna Roberts.
Check out new episodes of Sit-In every week, exclusively on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or PodcastOne.com.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
Caitlin Doughty is an eloquent advocate of the good death, and we'll get to her definition of that term in just a moment. You may know her as the author of the New York Times bestseller Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Other Lessons from the Crematory, or as host of the ingenious YouTube series Ask a Mortician, or, for listeners in the Los Angeles area, as the founder of Undertaking LA, a nonprofit funeral home on Santa Monica Boulevard. In her sophomore book, From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find the Good Death, Doughty explores death cultures in Indonesia, Mexico, Japan, Bolivia, even select communities in the United States, with the profound implication that we, Americans, might do better for ourselves and the planet than currently encouraged by an insidiously corporatized funeral industry that swaps secrecy, sterility, and consumerism for communion with our own dead. And if that sounds a little bit impassioned for a books journalist, well, I used to work in the funeral industry, too. Caitlin Doughty, welcome to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today.
A dramatic reveal. I had no idea you worked in the funeral industry.
Dun, dun. Yeah, I used to.
I know. Da, da, da.
I did first calls, and I spent a rather ignominious week on cremations as well.
Oh, cremation didn't work out for you?
No, I'm more of a first call girl. And for those listeners who don't know what that is, basically, I and a partner would be the first people on scene representing the medical examiner's office or the funeral home to physically transport decedents from scene of death.
Right. So she's more of a body pickup girl than a cremation girl.
Yeah, you know, as we say in the biz. Congratulations on the publication of From Here to Eternity.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been I was actually just saying to a friend that it feels a little melancholy because you have all of the build up to the first week and you're like, promote, it's a book. I wrote a book. And then there's this brief lull. And I was just walking around an old cemetery in New England and feeling slightly melancholy about it all. But it's nice to be talking to you about it.
Nice to be talking to you, too. For the benefit of our listeners, could you please define the good death you mentioned in the book subtitle?
Hard. And I think it's gotten even more complicated recently with all of the bad deaths we see, whether it's natural disasters or what happened in Las Vegas. You know, there's so much bad death, police shootings that we see that it seems like a hard time to strive for the good death. But what I'll say is that, especially in America, if you don't give a real thought to what the good death means to you, whether that's dying at home, whether that's dying with little pain, means for your body, what that means for your memorial service and your continued place and remembrance in the world. If you don't have those conversations and you don't think about it, you don't have much shot of a good death at all. So you may not reach the magical, wonderful death you think that you deserve, but to have any kind of shot at something resembling what is meaningful to you at the end of life, you have to have these conversations. You have to figure out in advance what it is you want.
To that end, you founded the Order of the Good Death, a group of progressive funeral professionals, academics, and others united in support of what you call the death positivity movement. What are the aims of this movement?
The aims of the movement and death positivity, I didn't really set out to call it that, but I sent out a tweet that said, how come there's sex positivity and body positivity, no death positivity? And everyone went,
fair enough,
just seized on it and said, oh, great, this is what we call ourselves now. And it was like, okay, we're going with it. But what it means is not that we're positive when your mom dies and you just fuck up and get over it. What it means is that it's okay to be interested in death. It's okay to hear that you used to work in the funeral industry and say, what was that like? What does it look like behind the scenes? What do these other cultures do with death? What do they do historically with death? I want to visit this old cemetery. It's okay. Morbid is not a pejorative term. It's okay to be interested in death and all the things around it because it's not a niche thing. It's going to happen to us all, and you might as well be open about it and be interested.
Agreed. And From Here to Eternity is obviously of a piece with that advocacy. What's the book's origin story?
Well, the book has a very long origin story. I actually wanted to write it before I even entered the funeral industry.
Wow.
I've always been wanted to travel to every place I travel to around the world. What I'm most interested in is what I call the death destinations, destinations. And that's always been something I've been fascinated by. And then I got for so long, so deep into the world of the American funeral industry and reforming the American funeral industry. And it was only really when I finished the first book and was able to take some time that it occurred to me that it was time to look around the world as well. Because really what happens all the time is you have the American funeral industry that, as you mentioned at the top, has a lot of problems. It's very corporate. It's very, very expensive. It's very over-sterilized. And yet people in America who have never been exposed necessarily to anything different, when they hear about some place where they mummify the dead or they keep a skull in the home, all of a sudden they go, oh, that's so disrespectful and disgusting. And oh, how would they do that to the body? Well, if you actually learn about it, there's this incredible story of ritual and meaning behind why they do these things that really goes far beyond what we do with our own dead here in the U.S. So my hope is that people will read it and go, oh, there's actually so much more that's possible for our own death here in the U.S.
I want to know a little bit more about how you chose your death destinations, what qualities you were looking for in these different funeral rites, death cultures.
What I was really looking for, first of all, were things that haven't been covered extensively. Mm-hmm. So the pyres along the Ganges River in India, or these fantasy coffins in Ghana that are shaped like cell phones and chickens. And these are all very, very interesting things. And I'm sure that I would have gotten a lot from being there. Mm-hmm. But journalists have really covered them very well. And I wanted to go to the stories are much less frequently told. Mm-hmm. And it was always places that I had some kind of specialized access. The death world is actually very small. So
yeah.
Someone will ask me, you know, have you heard of this mushroom burial suit? Or have you heard of corpse composting? And, you know, your first response is, yes, thank you so much for telling me, though. But really, subconsciously, you're thinking, yeah, because we've been friends for years, because there are only like 15 of us total who are doing this kind of public death awareness, the new death world work. So knowing all those people was such a boon to being able to get this specialized access to places here in the U.S. and places around the world. So the places I picked kind of chose me because they were places that I knew that I had access that the average person, it wouldn't be possible for them to get.
Well, for example, what's going on in Crestone, Colorado that's remarable in the way of death?
They are one of my favorite places in the world. They're doing basically their own death care for the town, which is something that almost no other place in the Western world really does. And they opened an open-air pyre, the only public one in the Western world at all. And when somebody dies in the town, they'll come in as a nonprofit for $500, which is unheard of in the American funeral industry, and
right.
They'll help you take care of the body at home. And then 2 or 3 days later, at dawn, they'll take the body out for an open-air pyre cremation. And when you're there, it's just gorgeous. It's just the most, you know, I'm not a spiritual person, but it's just the most spiritual thing you can imagine as the smoke twirls up into the dawn sky. And given that most crematories are incredibly industrial, it's a really nice change, and it makes the actual process of cremation feel like a much more, I guess, meaningful thing than it does in an industrial environment.
Absolutely agreed. And as you mentioned in the book, most people who go for a more industrialized cremation don't know that, in fact, you can be present for that. You can have a placement. That's what they...
Exactly. I think that's one of the things from my first book that I get the most feedback on mm-hmm. is that I had no idea until I read your book that I can show up at the cremation, that I can be there. I can watch mom be loaded into the machine. I can push the button. I can cut a lock of her hair. It was just assumed, or is assumed by most people, that once the funeral home takes the body, especially for a cremation, that it's verboten, that you shall not pass into the back. You can't be present. You just have to take on faith that she's going to be okay back there. And people want to be more involved than that. And yes, it's not the beautiful pyre at dawn, but it's still at least being able to be there in her final moments.
Speaking of a culture you visited that's way more involved, in Indonesia, on the island of Tana Toraja, there are people who practice an animistic religion, the name of which roughly translates to the way of the ancestors. So for many, many, many generations, they have been practicing some of the most complex funeral rites in the world. Would you please tell our listeners a little bit about them?
Yeah, and they are converted to Christianity at a certain point in the early mm-hmm. 20th century, or you know, it's taken a while, so throughout the 20th century, but yeah. There's still so much left over from this Aluk Tudolo, which was the older animistic religion, still so much present. So you'll have these really fascinating funeral rites, and then there'll be a picture of Jesus on the grave. Oh, okay. This is a hybrid.
Hi, Jesus.
And what they, hey, Jesus. And white Jesus too, which is always interesting. But, they have a system there where when a person dies, or a belief there that when a person dies, they're not fully dead. They have something more like a high fever, or a sickness, but they're between the worlds, I guess. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they mummify the body. And the old way that they used to preserve the bodies were with teas or tannins, and it was this very long, complicated process. But in more recent modern days, they use formaldehyde and formalin, like an American embalmer would. And they keep the body in the home for sometimes a couple of months and sometimes for years. And they'll live with the mummified body of their mother or their brother in the home. And that's pretty horrifying for a Western audience. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was so interesting about being there, these bodies, and even when they bury the bodies or put them in these graves, above ground graves, they still take them out every 3 years or so to clean them and redress them.
And actual mummified body.
Actual mummified bodies wearing, you know, shirts, paisley tuxes and
aviators,
normal outfits, aviator boxer shorts, watches, suits. They remove all the clothes, clean, brush off the mummy and redress them. And this seems horrifying to us. But I think the interesting thing about being there for all of this is normal, it feels, when you're there. You know, there's an excitement in the air because this is a festival and all these people have come in, family have come in from out of town. But when you're sitting there, it's just like, oh, everybody's hanging out. There are children running around. They're having guys smoking, you know, eating food. Like, everybody's just hanging out, and there happens to be mummies everywhere, mm-hmm. out in the sunshine, hanging out in the along the road, you know, just it feels really normal, and you get used to it so quickly.
So therefore, what do you think it says about us when we feel shock or horror hearing about these death rites that are different from our own?
I mean, it's so close to how we feel about so many things in mm-hmm. other cultures when we don't actually seek to understand why people do it.
Yeah.
There's no culture that just throws away their dead. There's no culture that is intentionally disrespectful to their own dead. Every culture is either trying to do the absolute best they can because they love the person, or they're trying to do all of these rituals because they're afraid of some kind of afterlife haunting, or if you don't do everything right, the spirit will come back and be displeased. But in any situation, there's no culture that's just like, whatever, it's a dead body, I don't care, screw it, toss it in the dumpster. Nobody does that. I don't really think there's, you know, almost anybody who's ever done that. And in the rare cases where they do just dispose of the body, there's still ritual and there's still all of these things to it. So the idea that weaken other people by mm-hmm. pretending that they don't care about their dead or disrespect their dead is something that we see in so many other areas as well. So it's not surprising to me, but I think in a way, death is the best way into cultural relativism mm-hmm. and seeing cultures as equal, because with something like, you know, a culture where they don't let women drive or they don't let women have rights or they're incredibly discriminatory against LGBT people, it's much harder to say, oh, just let the culture do what they want to do because it offends us so deeply. But with death, them mummifying their dead doesn't affect you at all, and it means a lot to them. So, open your mind a bit and learn about it and see why they do it and hopefully accept it.
One thing I was despairing to learn is that I will not, no matter how hard someone presses my cremains into the seed of a tree, I will not become a beautiful tree when I die, even if I opt for a green burial.
I know. And this is, I feel like such a destroyer of dreams here because people are so excited
about
becoming a tree. And listen, you can be scattered underneath a tree. You can certainly still be buried with a tree. And that's lovely. You will be eternally hanging out with a tree that hopefully grows. But the perception is that if you put ashes in one of these newfangled urns that's supposed to turn it into a tree, that the ashes are nourishing the tree and becoming part of the tree. But unfortunately, ashes are inorganic bone fragments, and they are not nourishing the tree.
Well, whatever a good death ends
hopefully,
up meaning.
Yeah.
What?
Hopefully it won't kill the tree, though. I don't want to be too much of a Debbie Downer here. It could be tree adjacent.
Caitlin, come on.
Tree adjacent. Yay! How lovely.
Whatever the good death ends up meaning to our listeners, I hope that this will spur them to explore it. And I hope that they will pick up what I consider to be a very important book, From Here to Eternity, by Caitlin Doughty.
So, good death, Megan. I wish one for you.
Thank you, Clay. For you as well. I personally would like to just be, have a direct burial, you know. A cremation would be fine, too. Honestly, I don't, you know, it's kind of up to the survivors, I believe.
Yeah, I disagree. I just want a green burial, and that's it.
Want to be a beautiful tree?
Yes, I'm going to turn into a tree.
A tree adjacent, as we learned from Caitlin.
That's right. I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree adjacent tree.
Honestly, though, I think that what she does, bringing attention to, you know, what's going on in the death industry is super important because some people, you know, it is such a surreal time in so many families' lives that it's hard to get your bearings. And often you end up making decisions maybe that you wouldn't have had you had more time to consider, you know, your options or knew your options.
And yeah, and there are people happy to make money off of you during that moment. So just too bad. So let's call up our editors. It's the time of the show when we evaluate the bestsellers and our editors let you know what we think about them and whether they're any good. So this week we've got our children's and teen editor, Vicky Smith, and our fiction editor, Laurie Muchnick. Our nonfiction editor, Eric Liebetrau, is on vacation. So Vicky, let's start with children's and teen. What's a bestseller that we're liking this week?
Well, one bestseller that we are really happy to like is one of the coolest publishing phenomena of the year, and that is The Purloining of Prince Oleomargarine, which is it's an original fairy tale by Mark Twain, and it was never published in his lifetime. In fact, it was never actually assembled into anything that was an actual story. He had just taken notes about this fairy tale that he was telling to his daughters. But the notes just sort of hung around and hung around, and some brilliant person decided to join those notes to the storytelling and artistic talents of Philip C. and Aaron E. Stead. Aaron E. Stead won the Caldecott a few years ago with A Sick Day for Amos McGee, which Philip C. Stead had written. And so now you have these two prodigious modern talents working with this dead, incredibly prodigious talent to make this very, very cool story about a little black boy named Johnny who has to sell his pet chicken, and he gets seeds in return, and they enable him to talk to animals, and he and the animals help to rescue Prince Oleomargarine when he is kidnapped. It's great.
Hmm, that sounds nice. Beautiful artwork, too.
Oh, yeah.
Cover of that book is beautiful.
And the whole thing is beautiful. I mean, it's very thick for an illustrated book. It's 160 pages with just, you know, lush, fabulous illustrations. Spared no expense, and the book has benefited tremendously from the dedication that they put into it.
Yeah. You think Twain would be proud?
Well, I don't claim to channel Twain, but it's hard to imagine how he couldn't be. Let's just put it that way. It's beautiful.
All right. That's a vote of confidence. And what is something we might want to skip in children's books this week?
Well, probably you might want to skip I Am Gandhi by Brad Meltzer, illustrated by Christopher Eliopoulos. And the two of them have a series called Ordinary People Change the World, in which they imagine the it's picture book biographies, very, very slim, streamlined biographies of famous people. They've done Jim Henson and Jackie Robinson and Albert Einstein. And one of the signatures of this series is that their title character is drawn with an enormous head, but with the adult face on top of a kid-sized or kid-proportioned body. And so for the Gandhi story, you have this giant old beneficent Gandhi face where, and he's wearing a dhoti as a small child, and which is, I mean, it's just weird, but it's also all wrong because Gandhi did not adopt the dhoti as a small child. And it's simplistic. The illustrations take a pretty well-recorded instance from Gandhi's youth and really distort it in a way I find shockingly irresponsible. It's a mystery to me how these books keep coming, but they do. You can keep skipping them.
Yeah, so now we know to skip it. Okay, thank you.
All right, Lori, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing very well. How are you, Megan?
I'm well. Thank you for asking. What's tops in fiction for the week?
Well, this is a book that people have been waiting a long time for. It's Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan, her first book since A Visit from the Goon Squad, which won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize. So this one is totally different from Goon Squad, which was a kind of, you know, very contemporary book that told its story through kind of linked stories. And one chapter was a PowerPoint presentation. And, you know, it was very experimental. This is a straight ahead historical novel, beautifully written, you know, fully imagined, starts out in 1934 when a 12-year-old girl named Anna and her father, Eddie, go to the Brooklyn home of a mobster named Dexter. Well, because Eddie, the father, is trying to get a job because it's the Depression and he's just scraping by. He has another daughter who's in a wheelchair and he needs money to take care of her. So we just get this one scene, and then we skip ahead 7 years, at which point Anna is 19. She's working at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. She's the sole support of her family because her father, Eddie, disappeared 5 years earlier. Somehow she elbows her way into a job as the first female diver at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. So there's a lot of great color about going underwater and being a scuba diver at that time, which was a really new thing to do. And meanwhile, she runs into Dexter, the mobster who her father had taken her to see years earlier. She runs into him in a nightclub and has an affair with him. He doesn't realize who she is. So these three characters, we see all of their stories. We see Eddie's story, even though he's disappeared. And we see the way they are intertwined. And Egan wraps the whole thing up beautifully at the end, but I won't tell you how.
Oh, my God. I'm so excited about that. I really am. I got to get a copy of that. Okay, so we've got a big, exciting new one. What might we want to skip this week in fiction?
Well, as has been usual lately, there's been nothing terrible, but called Winter Solstice by Ellen Hildebrand. Hildebrand is mostly known for her books, her set on Nantucket during the summer. But a few years ago, she started writing a winter series. So now she's got two books coming out every year, which, as I think I've mentioned before, doesn't necessarily make for the highest quality always. So this book it's the fourth in a series set at Christmas on Nantucket, based around an inn the Winter Street Inn. It's owned by a family. There's the patriarch, Kelly, and his wife and his two ex-wives and all the various children he has with all three of them. And in this book, it seems to maybe be the end of a series because Kelly is in hospice and he's dying. And, you know, it's not a terrible book, but apparently the most interesting crises just get wrapped up too quickly. Everything feels like it's kind of a wrap up. But then at the very end, it's a little bit ambiguous. So maybe the series not over after all, but it's a little mystifying.
Have you ever visited a summer resort town in the winter?
Yeah, actually, for decades, my family spent Thanksgivings in Southampton on Long Island, and it's fantastic. There's nothing like a resort town in the winter. It's quiet and, you know, nobody else is on the beach. It's really fun.
And the rates are excellent.
And the rates are excellent. I've never been there in the summer. Who knows what?
Well, I mean, an interesting idea at the very least. But now we know. Buy it, skip it. Thank you very much, Lori.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys. So that is this week's episode. Join us next week, the October 31st Halloween episode. As for what you need to do right now, I think you know what it is. Turn this podcast off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hey there, I'm Victoria Shade, and I'm the host of PetMD's Life with Pets. Now, this is a fun, all about dogs and cats kind of show where I get to interview subject matter experts, answer some listener questions, and help you become a better pet parent along the way. Now, we've had some really amazing guests on the show, including My Two Cents host Bill Engvall, who told me all about his amazing dog Jake, and Adam Carolla, who gave me a crash course in all things Phil. You can listen to PetMD's Life with Pets exclusively on Podcast One, the new Podcast One app, or Apple Podcasts. And guys, it would be a huge help if you could rate and review the show so other people can join the pack.